This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
Welcome back, everybody, from the break. I am very excited about our next speakers, which will be a self-advocate panel talking about mental health. We have Hari Srinivasan, who's a neuroscience PhD candidate at Vanderbilt University and a graduate of UC Berkeley. His graduate research examines sensory motor systems in autism, while his undergraduate work explored the emotions of awe and empathy in autism. His research has been recognized with several prestigious honors, including the National Science Foundation Graduate Research Fellowship, the Paul and Daisy Soros Fellowship, and the Berkeley Haas Fellowship. In addition to his work as a neuroscientist, Hari engages in meta-science, examining how research methods, assumptions, and inclusion practices shape what becomes accepted scientific knowledge. Rishi Jena is also with us. He's a minimally speaking autistic student. He graduated with the highest honors from high school in 2022 and is now a junior student of counseling at Arizona State University with a GPA of 4.25. He recently earned a certificate in clinical psychology. He's passionate about helping autistic individuals secure mainstream education and enhance mental health of the population. He's offering public school counseling services by writing custom public school success and transition plans based on each student's unique needs, and also offers peer counseling, peer mentoring, and life coaching sessions. And he is a gifted writer and poet and writes a regular poetry column in the local Atlanta magazine and enjoys working out at the gym, hiking, listening to music, movies, and reading spiritual books. We also have Commissioner Hector Manuel Ramirez, a disability rights advocate who is autistic, a domestic violence survivor, hard of hearing, long COVID, and has a psychiatric disability. They are Mexican and of Apache ancestry. Hector works with county, state, and national organizations, as well as policymakers, to advance legislation that reduces health disparities and improves outcomes for equity-seeking populations. Their advocacy work in this area has been instrumental in increasing access to mental health services for individuals with disabilities. So welcome, speakers, and we'll start with Hari.
Hi everyone, I am Hari Srinivasan. I wear many hats. My lived experience of disability shapes me. Neuroscience trained me, thought leadership grounded me, and storytelling helps me connect it all back to people. I want to start with the reality high support autistic people live in. Many already face discomfort from co-occurring health issues and sensory overload. On top of this, since the disability is very visible, they face stigma on almost every front. It is not uncommon for staff and professionals to talk about them, in front of them, as though they are not there, sometimes in ways that are dismissive, infantilizing, or dehumanizing. They are likened to a block of wood, incapable of understanding, which makes it okay to voice out comments that would never be said in front of a non-disabled person. On top of that, there are low expectations, jokes, eye rolls, pitying tones, and decisions made over their heads. This isn't a one-off bad day. It's often a lifelong pattern of chronic stress. If this level of ongoing stigma and loss of dignity were happening to a verbal person, we would have no hesitation calling it a serious mental health risk, and likely a source of anxiety, depression, and trauma. Ironically, mental health care often isn't just hard to access, it isn't even on the menu. Systems focus on housing, basic self-care, supervision, and behavior management. When families and close supporters ask for mental health help, they're usually redirected to behavior plans and PRN medications for agitation, not to adapted therapy or trauma-informed care. Most providers simply don't take high-support autistic clients. They assume therapy won't work or is too hard to adapt. The result is years of anxiety, depression, and trauma that never receive proper attention. In my paper on anxiety in autism, I argue that anxiety isn't just an extra diagnosis. It's shaped by the interaction of brain differences, underlying physiology, health issues, together with sensory overload, unpredictability, social threat, and lack of control. For high support adults, that mix is often their entire environment. Over time, this mix doesn't show up as neat worry. It tends to appear at the extremes. One is acting out, which gets labeled as behavior. Another is shutdown and apathy, flat, withdrawn, only doing what's prompted, a kind of giving up where the person stops initiating at all. Then there's overcompliance, which is its own red flag. When someone is always agreeable, never says no, and goes along even when they seem distressed, that can signal fear, depression, or learned helplessness, not good adjustment. From the outside, shutdown, apathy, and overcompliance can look like things are going smoothly. From the inside, they may be anxiety or depression we simply haven't named. To understand why so much gets labeled behavior, it helps to look at the chain from body to words. First, interoception, the sense of what's happening inside your body. For many autistic people, those signals heart rate, gut, breathing, skin can be too loud, too faint, or just confusing. A racing heartbeat from exercise and a racing heartbeat from anxiety may feel the same. My heart is pounding, but not clearly good or bad. Then alexithymia makes it hard to turn those body signals into feelings and words. Instead of, I feel anxious, or, I feel sad, it stays at the level of, something is wrong. If you also have limited or unreliable speech, there's no easy way to explain any of it. So the distress comes out through actions, pacing, bolting, screaming, self-injury, collapse. The chart records behavior, but often it's emotion, with nowhere to go. This body-first, action-first pattern is especially common in high-support autistic adults, which is one reason their mental health needs are so easy to misread or overlook. My Neurodiversity 2.0 paper tries to update how we think about neurodiversity, focusing on both real challenges and real strengths. In that work, I talk about how often we fall into either or traps in autism. In this case, we ask, is this behavior or mental illness? Is this person high support or competent? Do we keep them safe or respect their choices? For high support autistics, those binaries are brutal. Label something behavior, and no one looks for pain or trauma. Label someone high support, and people stop inviting them into decisions or even trying. Treat safety and autonomy as opposites, and you get control without dignity. A neurodiversity-informed approach has to design for both real challenges and real strengths, safety and agency. Mental health isn't just about reducing crisis. Positive psychology asks, what makes life worth living? For autistics, that can include relationships with family and chosen supports, feeling needed and having a role, joy, and pride in what they can do, and special interests. For high-support autistics, those special interests may look like repeating the same video, knowing every detail of a cartoon, arranging objects in precise ways, listening to the same song on repeat, or spending long periods with water, lights, or textures. From the outside, that's often labeled fixation or stimming, but for the person it can be a major source of joy, comfort, and identity. Families and long-term supporters are often the main scaffolds that make any of this possible. But flourishing still has to be defined around the autistic person's own values and joys, not just around other people's convenience. Flourishing is not optional, mental health is a core part of human flourishing. If you don't even offer mental health care as an option, you've already decided that flourishing isn't for them. If we're not careful, positive psychology focus on strengths becomes just be resilient while nothing around the person changes. Flourishing language can be used to excuse poor access, or to blame families and individuals for not having the right attitude. For high-support autistics, flourishing isn't about thinking happy thoughts. It requires communication methodologies, stable and sensory-safe environments, trusted relationships, and some real say in daily life. Families and close supporters do a huge amount of invisible mental health work, regulating, advocating, watching for signs of distress, and they need support too. But that support should expand the autistic person's options, not just make it easier to maintain the status quo. I want to bring in my undergraduate research, as a Berkeley Haas scholar, on the emotion of awe, and how that could be used as a tool in the autistic coping toolbox. Awe is a body-first emotion. People often describe a brief, wow, response. You pause, take a deeper breath, and feel a kind of stillness or expansion for a moment. It can downshift stress and rigid thinking. It has this odd ability to both shrink the ego and expand your sense of humanity and perspective. That makes it very relevant to mental health. In our research, we found that nature was a major source of awe for everyone. But autistic people were especially likely to feel awe in science, patterns, big abstract ideas, or experiences of divine or absolute truth, and much less in social gatherings or other people's status. My read is that people are high stakes, social interaction costs effort, and carries a history of judgment. So what other people do triggers less automatic awe. Abstract worlds, by contrast, are on your own terms, so awe shifts there. Essentially, autistic awe takes a different path, but it's no less important for well-being and meaning. I want to be clear, awe doesn't replace therapy, psychiatry, or housing. But in a system where high support care is already incredibly expensive, and where wait lists can stretch into years, we also need tools that don't depend on another clinician or another appointment. That's where awe can be a low-cost, no-waitlist layer. Autistics, families and staff can build simple awe practices into daily life, short nature or awe walks, deep time in a special interest, music, poetry, or spiritual ritual. By micro-rituals, I mean tiny, repeatable moments that take less than a minute, pausing to really notice one cloud, one plant on the windowsill, one favorite song, or one photo long enough to feel a bit of wow. Often it's families or supporters who notice what truly lights someone up, and can protect those moments from being dismissed as obsession or wasting time. That's a very practical form of mental health support that doesn't require a clinician. I'll end with three takeaway questions. First, what hurts and what helps? With alexithymia and interoception differences, emotions often show up as body complaints and behavior long before words, so look for pain and overload, and also pay attention to what already soothes them. Watch for red flags, like loss of interest in things they used to love, new extreme compliance, or escalating self-injury, without a clear medical cause. Second, how can we reduce distress and increase meaning, treating health challenges, environment, while also protecting time and energy for special interests, relationships, and small awe practices that don't depend on therapist availability? Third, how can we keep them safe and expand their agency, using whatever communication is available to give real choices and co-write plans? For high-support autistic people, families and long-term supporters are often the backbone of survival. The work is to support them too, while still centering the autistic person's own body, voice, and goals. High support and high expectations can coexist. When we stop forcing autistic people into either-or boxes, we move much closer to genuine mental health and flourishing. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Hari. Rishi, I'd love to hear from you.
So I'm Rishi's mom, and Rishi has given me permission to present his slides for today. Go ahead and share. This is my mental health journey with Rishi Jenna. I want everyone to know that autism is not a cognitive disorder. Sensory overload and motor deficits make communication in daily life a terrible struggle. I feel that autism population is very high risk for mental disorders. There are many things that affect us on a daily basis. Rejection from family, extended family, like relatives, grandparents, even parents. Microaggressions from society on a daily basis. Underestimation. I was counting from 1 to 10, from grade 1 to 5, and I still could not convince my teacher that I know how to count. a lack of communication skills. I could not communicate until I was 12 years of old, and I had no way to show anyone what I knew. And this contributes to social isolation, segregation from society, and also once I did learn to communicate, I was carrying my keyboard to general education classes, and people were laughing at me, all the students. And this related to chronic stress from this rejection, microaggressions, isolation. So this is kind of my life through my school years. How I defined myself then and now. When somebody asked me how I felt as an elementary school student, I said I felt like a piece of trash. I was nonverbal. I was averaging 1 to 30 aggressive behaviors every day. I was angry, frustrated, very lonely and hopeless, and also not challenged. Now, as a junior in college, my life has changed tremendously. I have a life of purpose. I have some functional speech. I have much more control over my hands. I'm excited for the future. I am a lot more engaged, and I have big dreams right now. And I'm also intellectually stimulated in college. Some days are still challenging, though, with aggressive behaviors and meltdowns due to sensory pain or overload. But those days are few and far between. Wanted to share a couple of pictures of me as in elementary school where I couldn't make eye contact. I was lost. I did not connect with the world around me. And that's me now as a junior in college where I'm confident. I have good communicate. I have much better communication skills, and I can look people in the eye and I can have some functional conversations with them. How did this transformation unfold? I went from rejection to building up resilience. I also went from microaggressions to advocacy for myself and others like me. I went from underestimation to a college education. And right now, nobody underestimates me once they know that I'm going to college and I'm a junior in college. I also traded lack of communication to RPM. I used rapid prompting method, and now I can type independently, and I also have some functional speech. I went from social isolation to social connections and inclusion. Just the fact that I'm here in this conference today speaks volumes about being valued and also being included. I also want to mention how much peer mentoring and counseling meant to me during this journey. I relied a lot on a peer mentor. She had a brother on the autism spectrum, and she understood me, and she helped me from high school onwards to build up my self-esteem and build up coping skills when life got tough. And she also gave me pep talks for tough days. I also went for several counseling sessions where I learned to challenge my negative thought patterns and build up motivation to change and have a toolbox for life's challenges. I'm very concerned about the extent of the mental health epidemic in the autistic population. From my research, I have found that 40 to 50% of autistic youth were on more than one medication, and several of them who are experiencing self-injury, aggression, being male and older, had even higher risk rates. Very, very few of these people are going to cycle or counseling or any kind of peer mentoring service. One third of autistic youth are only using medication. I talked to 15 of my friends who have the same profile like me, who are non-speaking, have significant behavioral issues, and 100% of them are on medication. Some are taking more than three medicines, and a few of my friends are taking as much as six medicines. They're experiencing side effects like weight gain, dizziness, sleepiness, zoning out, and even maniacal laughing. But they have no other choice. They're continuing to take these medications. The most common diagnoses are anxiety, depression, stress, aggressive behaviors to self and others. And some of the drugs my friends are taking include Prozac, guanfacine, amantadine, Lexapro, Abilify, risperidone, Seroquel, and others. I was prescribed risperidone at age 7 for aggressive behaviors, and also Lexapro as a teen and diagnosed with anxiety. But so far, I have not taken any medication, and I have been able to control and turn my life around using counseling and peer mentoring. I got inspired to go to college to become a licensed counselor to help the autistic population. And I seriously think that a prevention program is really needed for the autism community. We need evidence-based therapy techniques like CBT to help these autistic population. We need a mental health classes for parents who are also suffering from social isolation, microaggressions, from segregation, and also being bullied by society. We need group communication session. There are mentoring programs for many marginalized youth, but why not for the autistic population? There are no group counseling sessions, so we should have group counseling for all the autistic youth who are at risk. And we should also use public school for as the venues for these events, because the maximum amount of trauma to autistic students happen in public schools. I also want to use outcome and impact data for collection and monitoring this program. I have started a pilot of a peer mentoring program. I started last year, and I have so far mentored six autistic peers and children in the last year. I've shared my story of resilience and overcoming all odds. I have created a rapport and trust with these children, and I can understand them better than their own parents. I have attempted to motivate them to change their thinking patterns and build self-esteem. And here is a testimonial from one of the parents that I've worked with. They say, "We decided to pursue peer mentoring for our son to provide him with a positive role model who understands his emotional and physical challenges. Our goal is for him to receive the inspiration and feedback necessary to improve his emotional regulation, which is essential for his success in academics, therapy, and social environments as he works towards greater independence. Our son has significantly benefited from the weekly sessions. He's beginning to recognize that his challenges are not unique and can be managed through persistence and patience. We are very grateful for the time and energy you have invested in him. These sessions are undoubtedly an invaluable resource that will have a lasting, positive impact on his life." Garima and Paul. I am really overjoyed that I'm able to have this kind of impact, even if it's only one little boy at this point. And I can't wait to become a counselor, a trained counselor, so I can have a much larger impact on many, many more students in the autistic community. And here are my references. Thank you so much for this opportunity to speak here today.
Thank you so much, Rishi. We are looking forward to your career as well. Hector, we'd love to hear from you.
Good morning. Buenos dias. Ya ate. My name is Hector Ramirez. I am Chicago Apache and Mexican. I am joining you all today from the beautiful Los Angeles County. I am in my home with my family in the unceded land of the Tongva people, and I join you all and welcome you to this space. I'm a person with autism. I'm also a person with a psychiatric disability. I am a disability rights advocate, and I am now 50 years old. I will be 51 pretty soon. I've lived here in California for most of my life. I am the product of advocacy. I am somebody who got my diagnosis in 1978 here in the state of California. My first diagnosis was that of child schizophrenia, a mixed diagnosis that also came with an IQ test of 57. That was kind of the beginning for me and my family. As a Native family, we view disability differently. Our communities, our tribal nations have long had a history of child separation, particularly even more for people with disabilities. And so we recognize the danger sometimes of labels and the stigmas that they can associate sometimes. So disabilities just looked on as differently. So neither me or my family ever thought there was anything wrong with me. As divergent and different as I was part of my family, part of my community. Regardless to what some people say, people with disabilities have existed for a long time, including people with autism. As a Native person, I can tell you how we have stories of autistic people in so many of our tribes, way before Tylenol even existed, way before Some of the Western visitors landed on this lands, what is now the Americas. And so disabilities play a significant role in our identity of who we are. And now when I talk about myself, I talk about my name, about my cultural identity, my gender identity. I'm a two-spirit person, but I also share my disability identity. And the reason that I do that is to kind of reclaim the narrative. And I live with a mental health diagnosis. I have been a consumer of the Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health for the past 25 years. The Los Angeles County Department of Mental Health is the largest mental health provider in the United States, and it has the largest population of people with what some people would say mental illnesses, and that term just makes me shudder. As the term, as the art term used to make me shudder, because it has a stigma. And so over the years, many of us reclaim our identities and our narratives for survival, for support for mental health. And here in the state of California, mental health is one of our biggest accomplishments in the 2000s with the passage of the Mental Health Services Act. It revolutionized mental health services for the state of California. Then later on, thanks to the work of President Obama and President Biden, Vice President at the time, the passage of the Affordable Health Care Act, whoa, that just increased access for so many of us. For many of us that primarily used to get our services from regional centers, we now had access to more services. And there are sometimes discrepancies of funding that really impact the quality of care. But for many of us, being able to get services from the Department of Mental Health for the first time, really was significant. I heard earlier that we wear many hats, in this presentation. But as people with disabilities, we also wear many disability hats, and that's something that a lot of people struggle to recognize, particularly in the mental health field community. It's difficult for people sometimes to understand that people with mental health conditions, psychiatric conditions, are people with disabilities. And what that means is still a transformative process in this particular field. But I'm really excited that those of us who are more connected to the disability community or have multiple experiences, lived experiences, are able to articulate in many different forms to help uplift that narrative. Definitely the work that is being done by our peers is just so vital in the spaces where we lack so many necessary biomarkers to effectively have the best outcomes that we typically see in some other of our medical fields. The lack of medical biomarkers to accurately and consistently treat people across a lifespan really has still necessitated narrative, observation, dialogue, very discursive, very rhetorical type of process that oftentimes our medical providers, who sometimes could also be a little neurodivergent like us, really struggle to comprehend. And it's really hard sometimes to explain our humanity to our parents, to ourselves, and even sometimes the worst, to the people that are trying to help us when we really are at our most vulnerable times. So having our folks being able to speak for ourselves in the different ways that we do, it's vital to this particular work as we continue to expand on the narrative of care that we use for mental health, because that's really what it is, besides the psychopharmacological processes and some of the other interventions. The human interaction, the peer interaction, the accessibility of services, the competency, the respect for humanity of people who are struggling is ultimately, what some people would call a bedside manner, but for many of us, it just means the world to be recognized. I am somebody who has now, managed a degree. I have worked in many different settings, and even in those positions, it is not uncommon for people to refer to me by the R word behind my back and even in front of me because of their stigmas. The lack of stigma that exists in the mental health community is significant to a criminal level at times. At that developmental diagnosis and the compounding can be deadly. And we see that sometimes for our autistic folks who struggle to get, mental health services. We saw that definitely during the COVID pandemic. We've had people that struggle to get services, when they needed it, how they needed it. But we recognize that by working together and kind of looking at some of our previous practices, we can develop other modalities that help. As a Native community member during the pandemic, our communities relied on practices that we've had to do before. The COVID pandemic wasn't our first pandemic. It's one of many pandemics that for our communities still continue. And we recognize that the lack of services, the lack of community really meant that we had to look to each other for support. We took care of each other. We practiced community. We practiced respect. We recognized vulnerability. And we would try to create spaces of survival shared by tradition of respect. And those are some of the survival practices that so many of our tribal nations instituted during those times, not just for themselves, but for their autistic people, their people on the spectrum who all of a sudden, were like many of us, cut off from our community members. Those are some of the practices that we still do because we recognize those are not necessarily, clinically tested practices, but historically tested practices. And I say this by recognizing that our Native and Indigenous people are still here. Our disabled people are still here. We continue to be. It is only by taking care of each other and recognizing all of our differences and roles and the many hats that we wear. Sometimes we share hats. Sometimes I listen to psychiatrists when they're having a bad day. I know psychiatrists like people know people with mental disabilities. They're humans. They're just like everybody else. And it's a difficult thing sometimes to believe that I, as a person with a disability, I, as a person with mental health, know how you feel. I know what you're going through, and I do. I have now, at 51, have had 98 psychiatrists throughout my life. I have had almost 32 5150s. All of them were because people didn't want to hear what I was trying to say about how bad I felt, how bad a medication was making me feel, what the withdrawal was happening, or just how bad I just didn't want to be treated, the way I was being treated in places of care. The stigma sometimes is even more worse. And as somebody who's been institutionalized before, I am pretty much sad to tell you that in our systems of care, that institutionalization of stigma still exists. And it hurts. It really, really hurts. And I hope that if anything you can take away from this is to note the significant variance, the progressions, and the impacts that we experience in mental health, but also the solutions, the recommendations, and the successes that we are providing for our communities by taking care of our own. Just like you would take care of your family, we take care of a family. And for that, I thank all of you for being here and my wonderful presenters for joining me. I have known Hadi since he was a kid, and I am just in awe to be able to speak here with this wonderful panel.
Thank you so much. These are three incredibly insightful talks and so important. Can I start with you, Hector? I think by necessity, you've talked about how your community had to rely on itself and was very supportive, but I'd be interested if there are services and supports that you think should be funded by the state or through the regional center system, what would those be?
No, I definitely appreciate that. And I think we are very diverse communities as people, as human beings. And so really having, and I know it's very difficult sometimes because of funding, but having services that are culturally guided, culturally connected is very important for the people that are coming to your door. Be responsive. One model doesn't fit all. And I think that's something that we, for example, in our travel nations during COVID, one of the things that we did, we started having listening circles remotely and in person. And we included everybody in our listening circles from our different tribes, including folks with disabilities. And everybody participated in whatever space they were in, trauma and distress, in grief. But we did it in our traditional way. And for us, for many of us, our language and culture was stolen. So many of us don't have it. Some of us are rebuilding it. So by offering that culture as a foundation of trust, where all of us who come together and find community, it was how a lot of our folks, particularly our high needs folks with autism, were able to get the support that all of a sudden weren't there. And there were natural supports, there were community supports, because as an autistic person, like here in California, I was stuck at home and I was freaking out because it was like the city hospital. So I was like reliving PTSD. But instead, what I did, I used my autistic skills and I was working with Governor Newsom and his administration. And I got started on COVID campaigns and food pantries across the state. I think I heard Judy in there, my sister. She and I were, she was like leading the vaccine campaign. And we literally had parents that normally sometimes I would be scared to work with. We found reasons to find more in common with each other than not, because that's who we were. And I have never been more thankful for our communities as a type of care than that. And it still continues. Like we're still here, we're dealing with ice nonstop, and it still has that horrible chilling effect. And our communities are coming together like they're doing today. This is how we take care of each other. We show up for community. And community shows up for us. This is actually medicine.
Excellent. Excellent. I think we do need to come together. Thank you for that perspective. That's really very helpful today. Hari, I think you're the first non-speaking autistic person to graduate from Berkeley with David, and the first to pursue a PhD. You're changing our ideas about what's possible. And so, what do you think the value is of recruiting more non-speaking people into graduate school?
Thank you, Clarissa, for that question. College is an experience that no one should miss, and I'm happy to see so many non-speakers and minimal speakers now in college. My Berkeley experience was simply transformational, and getting to do it with David was super. Getting to do a PhD in neuroscience is delicious icing on that cake. Higher ed did not magic away my disability challenges, but it's greatly improved my quality of life. Coming to the question, I think there is great value in having folks like us in graduate education. Three reasons why. First, it expands what institutions imagine is possible. We have come a long way from when the late Judy Heumann was told she could not attend college because she was a fire hazard. The college-going autistic is no longer an anomaly. However, many advanced graduate programs still implicitly assume you need fluent speech to be included, which means that doors continue to be shut for many of us. But many like me have strong intellectual abilities that simply haven't had pathways into higher ed. So when someone like me enters this space and successfully navigates it shows the barrier was not communication, it was about access and expectations. This leads to a mental recalibration. Second, having someone like me in the role of autism researcher helps widen the questions asked, especially around how autism research participation itself can be made inclusive, because research findings reflect who all got to participate. Finally, it matters symbolically as well. When students see themselves in advanced roles, it expands their sense of what their own future could look like. Representation doesn't solve everything, but it sure opens doors that were previously closed. So the value is not just inclusion, it's better science, better institutions, and broader understanding of human value.
Thank you.
Thank you. R role models are so important. You've really helped a lot of people see a more ambitious future for themselves. And I hope the people from regional centers and service providers are listening that we're going to need different services to support people who want to pursue college and higher education. Rishi, peer counseling by and for non-speaking people is a very forward-thinking idea, and I think many people who are here today might be curious about how does that work? Talk therapy for someone who doesn't speak is a new idea.
This answer, do you, can I read it out for you, Rishi? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So Rishi said that we use speech, keyboard, writing, anything we can to communicate during these sessions. We actually practice communication skills and mental health at the same time. And he also said that mentoring needs empathy, compassion, rather than being perfect in communication. And we understand each other.
So important, and having people who share life experiences, providing that support is so important. Thank you, all of you, for your insights today. I really appreciate it. This was an amazing, amazing talk. Thank you.
Good.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.